linkage of the military, and they have a certain view of how the state should function, and I think therefore they will support some of these initiatives. So I don't think the Egyptians are going to cross the border. That would be suicidal.
Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, author of several books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and most recently, The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. To see the rest of our interview, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Maté, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Daniel Vega, Anna Osbeck, Messiah Rhodes, Sam Riddell. Miguel Noguera is our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley and Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today we'll talk about turmoil in the Middle East.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Enemigo Imperialismo, Enemy Imperialism, a bilingual community art exhibit that explores the dimensions of imperialism in the world today. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. Artists around the world have responded to violence with work that questions the legitimacy of the state and empire. Enemigo Imperialismo points to one of our common targets in the fight for global justice and invites us to reflect on power, resistance, and self-determination. Again, that's Enemigo Imperialismo. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. The show will be up until September 25th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Is hypnotic.
Oh, it's lovely. It's lovely music.
Listen to that for hours.
Oh, and that's the idea.
Oh,
I think.
Okay.
All right. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. You can call us at 231-8187. We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff, but mainly focusing on issues of Islam these days.
Yeah, and issues.
And history. And
Islam history. In those days.
In those days. So, what I don't know, and I have no way of knowing this, is what people, what people's understanding of the history of Islam is. So I'm going to run through that in a little bit.
But wait.
But wait.
This is 90.7 FM.
Did I not
KBOO,
say that?
You did not.
I did not say that.
You did say it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
Well, that's all
that
matters.
Which is true. And we are taking your calls, 503-231-8187. Also, your comments on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/AbeandJoe.
How modern.
Yes.
We're really up to date.
Yeah.
Well, you are. I'm not. I'm a Luddite. I don't pay any attention to any of that.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about Islam and the tradition of the caliphate. And I don't know how heavily into this historic material we want to get. How long I should be talking. So you start hitting me when it gets, well, tap my arm or something.
No, I'm glad you're doing this. I think that this, in a lot of people's minds, the history of Islam is not very clear. People know a whole lot more about the foundations of Christianity and Judaism than they do about Islam. And those are the three great religions of the book, as they're called.
As they're called, and very influential. Two of them, Christianity and Islam, are charismatic religions. That is, they are into expanding themselves and increasing their membership to involve the world.
Ah.
The idea of salvation.
How generous.
Well, yes, the idea of salvation and enlightenment being something that all people should experience. I mean, that's the idea.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Look at that guy over there. He's not enlightened enough. Well, let's beat him until he's more enlightened.
Or chop his head off.
Okay.
Okay, let's talk about this. First of all, Muhammad was born about 570 A.D., so he's a fairly recent figure in that sense. And he wrote by tradition, or dictated by tradition, the book known as the Quran, which contains stories, if you read it, stories that are both within the tradition of Judaism and within the tradition of Christianity, as well as new material having to do with this new faith.
Now, is it true that Islam both acknowledges and venerates prophets from the Judeo-Christian tradition?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. But they're not emphasized as much as they might be historically. So he was driven out of Mecca, Muhammad was, about his argument was that there is one God, Allah, and that all the other religions, which were numerous and included Zoroastrianism and a whole bunch of other stuff, were not authentic, were in fact wrong. And his attitude, his intolerant attitude, together with the power of his preaching, really frightened the merchant class and the moneyed classes in Mecca. So he was essentially had to run for his life.
Now, that part of the world at the time, how was it organized religiously?
They were not caliphates, or they were not religious states per se. There were many religions contending, Judaism among them, by the way, Christianity another.
Okay.
So
and also probably some what we
well,
might lump into.
Zoroastrianism was very big.
We might broadly call pagan faiths of various kinds.
Well, I don't like that word.
But
yeah, broadly not Christian, broadly maybe. Not Jewish.
Possibly not polytheistic.
Some were polytheistic, some were monotheistic. But all of them were not the teachings of Muhammad. So he fled to Medina, having preached a religion that was intolerant in the sense that he argued there was only one God, and then in time he was regarded as the prophet of that God, having dictated or written the Quran. So, and the term Muslim simply means one who submits to the will of God.
Huh.
And so the word Islam means submission itself. So he fled to Mecca in 622. That trip, the fleeing, is called the Hijra. And in 630, he returned in relative triumph to Mecca. Many people having seen the light, many people having discovered the wisdom of the tradition of the religion. And in this case, in Mecca, the Kaaba, this mysterious stone, probably a meteorite, and the structures around it were rededicated to the new religion. And this became the center of the faith. in this period of time, he died in 632. There are various traditions about his death. One of the significant traditions is the idea that he went to Jerusalem and ascended to heaven on a winged horse.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
That's very cool. And that is not official. That is not, you know, that is a folk tradition that became part of the faith.
It has some real world modern ramifications,
well,
though.
It does, because the dome of the
rock, that rock is located.
Yeah, the dome of the rock and the mosque on top of it would be the second most sacred site of Islam.
Yeah, but it goes a little deeper than that. That rock is also allegedly the same rock upon which God commanded Abraham to sacrifice his son.
Right.
In the Jewish tradition.
Right.
Right. And it was later the site of the first and second great Hebrew temples.
Right.
Now, of course, occupied by a mosque.
Right.
And which really irritates Benjamin Netanyahu.
Right.
So much so that he took a journey there a few years ago.
Well, actually, it was, I think it was Rabin. I'm not sure.
No, it wasn't Rabin. It was Netanyahu.
It was Netanyahu.
Yeah, and touched off an intifada.
Right.
Yeah.
So you know, we will get into the question of Israel/Palestine very soon. But in the process of this return to Mecca and the triumph that was involved in that, the idea of spreading the religion included two things: an intellectual realization of the nature of God and his prophet Muhammad, and the use of military force to create a caliphate, that is, a nation state which is religious in origins and which is materially united all over the region. And this is a very important idea. This caliphate is a very significant idea, which I'm pretty sure most Westerners most Americans certainly don't grasp.
Well, the specter of the caliphate was used under the Bush administration after the September 11th attacks to whip up fear amongst evangelical Christians here in the United States, as in, we've got to stop these people because they want to reestablish the caliphate and more importantly, displace Israel.
Yeah. So essentially the faith spread very quickly, really. Very quickly, eventually taking over the various faiths in the Maghreb, the North African region. And his successor, Muhammad's successor, was Abu Bakr, who was elected the first caliph. And the notion of jihad, that is, holy war, was enshrined in the faith at that time. This is very important to understand. And the success of it was immense. The faith very rapidly spread, to the extent that it contained most of Spain, all of North Africa, all of the old Persian Empire, all of the what we call the Middle East, and extended into India, and was a dominant force in India for a long, long period of time, and extended all the way into Indonesia and places like that. Hmm. So it was a very successful religion.
So it's accurate to say that part of Islamic doctrine includes spreading the faith at the point of the sword, as it were.
I would say the doctrine in modern terms is spreading the faith. Part of that is the use of force where necessary.
Right. Well, it's a metaphorical sword.
Yeah. Yeah. It's right. Both metaphorical and real, unfortunately real in some cases. So the notion of a caliph and Abu Bakr, the first of these, and the notion of jihad, holy war, to spread the faith, in 100 years, this all took on all of that space. I mean, this is a big empire.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a religious / temporal faith with very complex organization, frequently based on traditions before Islam, but always a very powerful and very significant force. It was finally stopped in its spread into France from Spain at the Battle of Tours in 732. And Iraq, Persia, so on, became part of the faith. The whole notion of the unity of God, of the possibility of paradise, are part of this. And the rules included, for example, no portraits of human beings. There's never been a portrait of Muhammad. No presentations of animals. So when you look at decoration on most mosques, it will be flowers, and it will be it'll be various abstract forms, but not representations in most cases of humans and animals. So there are five pillars, five basic rules that if you are to become a member of Islam, a follower of Islam, you agree to follow. The first, of course, is that there is but one God, Allah, and that Muhammad is his messenger. The second is the require of prayer five times a day. Now, the prayer varies a little bit by whether you're a follower of the majority sect, which is Sunni, or the big minority sect, which is Shia. But basically it's the same, and it's five times a day, and there's a person whose task it is to climb to the top of a minaret, which is part of the structure of a mosque, who in the old days would use a megaphone or his own hands to call out to people to tell them it's time to pray. Nowadays, I think it's mostly electronic. You know, it's just amplified. At any rate, there's a Friday tradition of Sabbath. In prayer, in these five events, you wash your face, your hands, your feet, you face Mecca. You're led by a prayer leader, and you begin, you know, you both bow and kneel. The faithful are slightly different in their practice in the two different major sects. Now, so that's two things, acceptance of God and his messenger, five times a day prayer. The third thing is alms. The requirement, there are two kinds of alms. There's voluntary alms and there's required alms. 2.5% of your wealth is supposed to go every year to this process. This is socialism.
Right. It's very similar to the tithing tradition in Christianity.
Yeah, except that it's really, I think, was much more effective than the tithing tradition in Christianity. But I'm just making a judgment here.
Sure.
Then there's fasting. Ramadan, the ninth month of the Islamic calendar. Now, the Islamic calendar is a moon-based calendar. So Ramadan can over the years, move. And it can be a very hard holiday if it comes, say, in August, and relatively easy if it comes in January or February. In this period, you fast all day, all the sunlit hours. No eating or drinking during this period
of time. Or sex.
Pardon me?
Or sex.
No, right.
No eating, drinking, or sex.
No, yeah, right. I wasn't going to get into that, but yes, no sex. And there are exceptions. Travelers, soldiers on the march, sick people, nursing mothers.
Players in the World Cup, as it turns out.
Yeah, so it would seem. And the end of the holiday is a big celebration with lots of nice food, with gifts. It's like, it's, I don't want to say it's
and
like.
And sex, one would presume. I'm sorry,
God,
go ahead.
What is it with you and sex? This is not important. But I don't think it's a big deal. Anyway, maybe. Anyway, this holiday and the breaking of the fast is a very large, very important holiday. It's, you know, it's a functional equivalent, I would say. I'm loath to say this because there is no functional equivalency, but it's like in terms of its impact on people's lives, like Christmas.
It would be like if Mardi Gras came at the end of Lent instead of at the beginning.
Right. I guess that's fair to say, except that I'm not going there. Anyway, the final and fifth pillar is the pilgrimage, the Hajj. And that is, by the way, one of the insults that our soldiers hurled at followers of Islam during the Iraq War was that they were Haji. Haji simply means person who has made the Hajj. The Hajj is to Mecca. And every Muslim that can, and this is about men. All of this is about men, by the way. To a great extent. Not that women are not followers, but women do not take a lead role in the faith. They maintain the home. They maintain the children. They have a function that's very important in child education and reproduction, since you like sex a lot. Okay.
Well, we mentioned that as an aside, but I kind of think that's a pretty big deal. Maybe we should come back to that.
Which is a pretty big deal?
The role of women within Islam.
No, it is a big deal. Yeah. It is a very big deal, and it is probably... it may well turn out to be the Achilles heel. Another reference.
Yeah. Pagan.
Right. Okay. So, the leader of a community of followers of Islam is an imam, and his role is to interpret and make clear what the Quran says about this or that.
Hmm.
And he also leads prayer.
Are Muslims not free to consult the Quran of their own will?
Of course they're free to consult the Quran.
But the imam's going to tell them what it really means.
In the same sense that a minister does, it's an interpretive role,
right.
But it is authoritative. And it has to do with having one of the things that Islam does in the modern world, and has for centuries, is it requires people, particularly children, to memorize as many verses as possible of the Quran.
Hmm.
And that process takes the place of discourse for many people. Now, to be clear, Islam also became, particularly in places like Spain and Baghdad, a religion of education and science.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at many scientific advances that took place in the Middle East and in India and so on, you see that science was advanced by Islam. In fact, Islam had a major role in creating modern mathematics.
Oh, sure.
Our number system is Arabic.
After the collapse of Roman civilization, that flame was largely kept alive by
Islamic civilization. Well, and one of the interesting things about Islam is that it ate up. It conquered much of Byzantium, which was the Roman Empire in the East, which became the last of Rome after the barbarian invasions. So this was a major, major blow to Christianity. And as Islam advanced, it went so far as the Danube River, and I've already talked about Spain a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Spain was an amazing place at this time. First of all, it is impossible for me to emphasize or underemphasize the beauty and the exquisite architecture that characterizes traditional Islamic art. That's number one. Number two, it is the case that in Spain, there was a kind of tolerance. Jews, Christians, and Muslims all practiced their faith and discoursed at the universities.
Hmm.
It was kind of a cool thing. And that all collapsed in 1492.
Boy, did it collapse.
Yeah. Did it collapse. In 1492.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
When the Spanish took over, the Spanish got Spanish kings got a special permission from the Pope to conduct the Inquisition. And they, unlike all other Catholic countries, the kings of Spain were called their most Catholic majesties.
If you want to know more about the Inquisition, I recommend a Mel Brooks musical number. Just Google it. It's wonderful.
Okay. I don't agree with that, but that's cool. But in the 600s, there was a split between the Sunni and the Shia. Essentially, the Sunni follow the idea that Muhammad's tribe elects the caliph to run the caliphate. In the Shia, there's descendants of Ali. And the death of Ali is a deeply mourned and felt event.
Ali was whom?
He was the son-in-law.
Son-in-law of Muhammad.
Okay. Okay, now, the whole phenomenon that we see a lot of pictures of followers of Shia, men whipping themselves with chains and bleeding, you know, and marching, that all is about the mourning of the death of Ali. And the destruction of that direction of Islam.
Now, the Shiites are a minority sect.
They're a very large minority sect.
Yeah. But they are outnumbered by Sunnis.
Right.
Most places.
Right. Oh, yes. Very much.
But not all places.
And then within that context, there are revivalist movements, fundamentalist movements, which are very strict in their interpretation of the Quran. The Wahhabi, who dominate Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
For example, also groups what we're seeing is the development of the Salafi sect within the notions of that charismatic requirement set. Okay, and these rules, these strict rules, right now are being enforced right now in a resurgent effort to create the caliphate in the Middle East. And the claim of that caliphate is essentially carried right now, at this moment, by an organization that we call ISIS, but is also ISIL. That is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which is also, and more importantly, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The Levant is Lebanon. Mm-hmm. It's Syria. It's also Palestine. So that becomes very important. The notion of the caliphate is extremely important. If you look at this on a map, it forms a kind of crescent from places like Libya and North Africa all across the Middle East and all the way into Asia. And this is the situation we are facing. Now, the reason why I think this new rise of Islam as a fundamentalist, aggressive movement is important is because the American people and the Westerners in general have no weapon, religiously speaking or philosophically speaking, to counter that. It's an irrational, in the sense that Christianity is irrational, or Judaism is irrational, or Buddhism is irrational,
or
not irrational, irrational.
Religious
any
faith
religion
is
system.
Irrational.
Right. And that it is compelling. It is a very compelling faith. Once you've submitted, once you're part of the community, you really feel a part of a community. You do the same behaviors, remember, five times a day. You do the same things. You exhibit the religion in the same ways. You give alms. You do all of these things, and it binds you to a community that is huge.
And also, you look to that framework of beliefs to resolve any number of human problems that come along.
Right. And there is there is a long tradition of law coming out of the teachings of Muhammad, out of the Quran. And that tradition varies from place to place. The harshest traditions include beheading of persons who are wrong, a whole bunch of stuff like that. Punishments for theft can include dismembering somebody. I mean, it is tough. And one of the things we're seeing with ISIS or ISIL is their insistence on a very harsh Sunni interpretation, such that they blow up or destroy mosques that are the mosques of followers of Shia.
I'm glad that we're more enlightened here and we just turn to things like the electric chair and lethal injection.
Well,
civilized.
And we also don't allow. I don't want to get into the whole question of freedom of movement and speech and so on. Clearly, we are not paragons of virtue in that aspect.
Islamic law, as you mentioned, varies from place to place, but it also calls for.
Sharia. Yeah. Pardon me.
It also calls for, in some places, for example, the execution of a woman who is a victim of rape, because on the grounds that rape would not have occurred had she not been desirable, had she not provoked and piqued the interest of her rapist.
Yeah, this is something I don't know. You really have a little sex thing going on with this, don't you?
Well, you know, we sort of glossed over the role of women in Islam, and I generally try to avoid cultural paternalism. This notion that we know best here in the West. But I got to say, executing a woman who is a rape victim because she was just too, you know, she was too much of a temptation. I mean, that's absurd.
The notion.
Barbaric.
The notion is that women are vulnerable and that the seed, the children of a woman should be in the family that she has been committed to through marriage. And therefore, a violation of that is a violation of that family tradition. And in fact, women are to be protected. That protection through time has evolved into the requirement of the veil. In some places, women are totally covered from head to toe.
Protected, yes, but also covered so as not to incite the lust of men.
Yeah.
Right. And we see echoes of this in Western rape culture, too. When people start asking if a woman is raped, they start asking things like, how was she dressed?
Right.
Or, was she drunk? Or things like this. They really have nothing to do with the fact that, she was a victim of a violent crime.
Yeah. I think if there is a problem, and I think there is, the inequity of the treatment of women in Islam, and I would argue to a great extent in much of Christianity and Judaism, that inequity is a grievance which probably will be, but certainly should be redressed in the near future.
I certainly hope so. And my comments should not be interpreted as an endorsement of some sort of idea that we've got things all figured out here in Western culture with regard to the equality of women and what women are forced to endure in our culture, because we haven't. But I like to think that maybe we've got things figured out a little better than Sharia law does.
I don't know enough of the Quran, and I don't know enough of practice of Islam to comment on the various behaviors of Islamic societies. It is the case that there is more or less modernization in parts of Islam, but clearly, for example, Saudi Arabia is still a Middle Ages culture in terms of these rules. And that's true in many other places as well. Now, there are things happening in the world that also have to do with nationalism and power relations in this argument for a caliphate.
Indeed.
For example, Americans may not know, but it's really important to understand that right now in Libya, there's a civil war underway around religious and political issues, and both Egypt and the Emirates have bombed in Syria. I mean, in Libya. Plus, there are these wars of liberation and war struggles around Islam between Shia and Sunni. The wars that took place between Iraq and Iran were both nationalist wars over turf, but they were also wars with a religious dimension. So this is a very important thing. And when this ISIS or organization moves, it is a very fundamentalist, very cruel. It has shown itself to be incredibly cruel.
Oh, yeah.
And it has blown up beautiful architectural sites. It will destroy all manner of Shia things. And if we remember Afghanistan, there were giant Buddhist statues that the fundamentalists in the Taliban blew up.
Indeed.
So the notion of a graven image is an abomination in Islam.
So I want to talk about the origins of this group ISIS, which has now carved out a pretty wide swath of territory. In Iraq and in Syria and in that part of the world. And interestingly enough, it owes its existence entirely, well, not entirely, but in large part to the U.S. military intervention in Iraq. So we've got a phone call. I'll suggest we take that phone call first, and then we'll dive into ISIS.
All right, 231-8187.
Heidi, good morning.
Heidi, good morning.
Hi. I want to ask something very respectfully of the two of you. I've listened to your program a long time.
Let me just say this, Heidi, before you ask. Neither of us is an expert on Islam.
That's why I'm calling. And
okay.
I want to at the outset say I'm saying what I'm saying very respectfully toward both of you. I've listened to your program for about 2 years.
Okay.
So I'm very familiar with your content. I like what you bring to the table. I want to ask a question and then I want to make a comment.
Okay.
Was there an effort on the part of either one of you or by KBU to bring a Muslim voice of authority on Islam, because we have a huge Muslim community here in Portland, bring into this conversation? That's my first question.
I think the answer to that is there have been people of that faith, experts and so on the station frequently. We haven't done that.
No. Let me.
I had to hold for 12 minutes. I just wanted to let you know that.
Go ahead. You guys
are trying to have a community conversation, so just let me. Okay. I'm trying to get to work, but I wanted to make sure I got this comment in.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I just want to say, first of all, that's disappointing, because what I feel like this conversation, and I've been listening to it for a while now, it's a perpetuation of the same side conversation by Western media. This is what you're doing. KBU raises the bar. And some of the comments you made are a little strange, and I'm just saying this from the perspective of someone who's organized with the Muslim community for a very long time in Portland. I've been in a lot of conversations with Muslim about Islam and about Muhammad from their perspective, living that faith that they have.
Well, can you speak to the specific things you feel we're either in error about or don't understand?
Well, unfortunately, I was on hold a long time, and so I can't really have to get ready for work. But what my point is, is that I'm just disappointed that there isn't somebody on. I think you should have made a bigger effort to try and bring someone into the conversation.
I think that's a fair point.
Secondly, I wanted to say that because that was not done, or maybe you weren't given the opportunity, I don't know, there's a lot being left out. I can't speak to so many points because I don't have enough time, obviously, that I have learned in conversation and participating in a lot of events and organizing with the Muslim community in Portland, and specifically around Palestine solidarity, where the beauty of Islam that I have learned reading the Quran a little bit and actually in conversation with Muslims about who Muhammad was and what Muhammad put forth about what he believed Islam was. And from that perspective, you then can see where these diversions happen, and when ISIS and all these other kind of misinterpretations of what Islam was originally intended for, you can see it clearly. And it's a really nice conversation to be able to sit with someone who follows Islam and can tell you how distorted it's become, and then you can then try and reinterpret what you see through Western media and how those things are conflated or misunderstood. So I think, again, I appreciate what both of you do, what both of you bring to the table on a regular basis, but I think that that's what's lost in this conversation. And since, you know, I know I've heard you guys before, but you're both white males of privilege. I'm a person with privilege, and we're losing a lot in the conversation by not having someone whose voice is continually marginalized in the media at the table to talk about Islam from their point and their perspective. And that's basically what I wanted to say. So thank you for letting me say
well,
that.
Well, sure.
Thank you for
that. Let me just point out that the station does have Islamic scholars from time to time. But yes, we are white males and enjoy
right.
a certain level of privilege.
And I think she's right. This conversation suffers from the lack of an expert on Islam.
Yeah, and the reason why we wanted to introduce this material today was because the vast majority of
thank you for the call, by the way.
Yeah, thank you very much. The variety of information that we're bringing is relatively simplistic and I think necessary because most Americans, and I have no idea who our audience is in the larger sense, have no idea about the traditions of Islam. And I think what I presented is accurate to the degree that it is what it is. There's much more than that.
Oh, certainly. Much more than certainly.
That. Yeah. And Islam has, in its impacts in the world, created beautiful art, beautiful architecture, beautiful music, beautiful poetry, an incredible set of wondrous things.
Right, and made enormous contributions to the history of science and mathematics.
I don't want to diss any of that. The fact that what we presented is inadequate and too short is inevitable. This is a great faith. It is huge. I think Islam is the second largest faith after Christianity.
In fact, one might characterize you and I as inadequate and too short, just in general.
Too short?
Yeah, well, okay.
Never mind.
Also, I have to say, though, that this, not all the talk radio hosts on this station do this, but Joe and I often will wait to choose our topic for an upcoming show until just a few days before, because we want to preserve our ability to be flexible and react to issues and events in the news that may come up quickly.
Yeah.
So I think we gain something in that, but we also lose something. And sometimes, as in this case, we didn't have enough time to rustle up a guest who can speak more intelligently about Islam.
Yeah, and I think it's important to understand the contradiction between a desire to present material, including guests, and to have the voice of you in the audience calling us. Many people say, as you indicated in your call, it takes too long to get on the air.
Yeah.
And it's true. We're not a commercial talk station. We don't have a screening process. We don't have a lot of the devices of professional talk radio. We do the best we can. We present the material that we think important to the topic we're going to be talking about, and that takes up time. But all we got is an hour.
Right. And I think what you and I do, Joe, I think is a strength of this show, is that we endeavor to provide context, which is often why we take a while to set up our topic at the beginning of the show before we bring callers in.
Yeah, and I can understand people resenting the fact they're hanging on, waiting.
Speaking of which, let's go to the phones.
Yeah.
All right, who's next, Steve? Oh, okay. Well, we'll come to that caller here in just a moment. Now, the reason we chose this topic today was because of ISIS.
ISIS.
ISIS is an acronym for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. It is.
It calls itself ISIL.
It does. Yeah. Yes.
The Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant.
And it has explicitly stated its intent to reestablish the caliphate that you discussed, the large swath of land that is organized as a religious state under the rule of a caliph who is devoted to Islam.
Yes.
And enforces Islamic law.
Right. And the interpretation of Islamic law in this case is very, in Western terms, is fundamentalist.
is fundamentalist. I'm glad you brought that up because we've been painting as long with a rather large, rather broad brush today. Mm-hmm. Fundamentalism, as you just stated, I think is at the root of the tactics employed by the group ISIS. It's behind their objectives. And I think that generally speaking, again, problems related with religion in the world are related to those extremists, those fundamentalists within a much larger group of worshipers. In other words, people who make the rest of them look bad.
Yeah, I think that's a fair. I think that's a fair assessment. I also think fundamentalism, as a phenomenon, from my perspective purely, is a not a good thing. I see it in Christianity. I see it in Islam, mm-hmm. and to some extent in ultra-Orthodox Judaism, though that is not a, a major force in Zionism itself. Let's go to the phones. 231-8187. Kurt, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to express my appreciation for the show this morning, and I just had one comment that was inspired by the last caller, the lady. Basically, you've spoken a lot in generalities and, you know, broad strokes and all of this, and comparing how we have things figured out to the way Islam may or may not. And the fact is, I mean, from my point of view, I think if religion is involved, it's going to be very, very difficult to have anything figured out. It's all interpretation, and it is all up to who is doing the interpreting. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, and from the standpoint of, you know, you're seeking out an expert, I really find that that would be very difficult because they come in many, many colors.
Mm. That's an interesting point. Mm. I know that in Portland there is more than one mosque, and I know that they have some differing views. I don't know enough about them to comment on that, and I think that we really need to appreciate the problem of our being outsiders. And I appreciate your call on this.
Not at all. A great show. Thank you very much.
And thank you for the call.
Okay. Okay. Who's next, Steve? Eric, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I had a question for you. Years ago, I read a book called The Arabs, and it was a history of the Arab people. And in that book, I believe it said that in the fourth or fifth caliphate, or the four or five generations past Muhammad, that all the Qurans, which numbered at that time about five or six, were recalled. And there's the suspicion that they were rewritten to suit the political and ideological feelings of the time.
I don't know anything about that, so I can't comment on it.
Oh, okay. Well, interesting subject. Thank you very much.
Yeah, certainly. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Well, history is... I can't comment as to that statements. Accuracy either, but Judeo-Christian history is rife with a number of episodes like that.
Well, in fact, the struggle to define Christianity, the role of Jesus, the various congresses of Christian patriarchs deciding exactly what was what, the creation of the Trinity, all of that stuff were things that were made post-Jesus.
Right, and all of that happened before King James I wrote the Bible. So
he didn't write it.
Oh, sure he did. All right, ISIS.
He had it written. All right, ISIS.
ISIS. The guy who started the movement that eventually became ISIS was has a name that might be familiar to you, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Mm-hmm. This was a guy, a young Muslim, whose face burned pretty brightly. He was a little bit young to be a mujahideen fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. But he nonetheless journeyed to Afghanistan mm-hmm. And found an ideological home there, although he did not ally himself with Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda, who was at the time, of course, based in Afghanistan. Then the attacks of September 11, 2001 happened. The United States invaded Afghanistan, deposed the Taliban, which impelled al-Zarqawi to flee back home to Jordan and thence to Iraq. There he lived a largely innocuous life for some time until he took up with al-Qaeda in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Then his star began to rise. He preached a particularly militant form of Islam. And this is at a time and a place when there was quite a lot of religious violence going on, as we all know, those of us who have followed the tragic history of the United States intervention in Iraq. What characterized al-Zarqawi, what set him out amongst his fellows, was the fact that he did not hesitate to use violence against fellow Muslims, particularly against Shiites. He was and remains, his followers remain, pretty brutal in their tactics. Zarqawi himself was killed by a bomb in 2006, but the movement he started endures and is now known as, of course, as ISIS. And at one time was allied with al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda, interestingly, sort of set up franchises much like McDonald's. There's an al-Qaeda in Iraq. There's an al-Qaeda in Algeria. There's an al-Qaeda in the Levant, and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So al-Zarqawi's group allied itself with al-Qaeda in Iraq. Once the so-called troop surge by the United States during that period played itself out, ISIS was more or less on its own organizationally, and of course in the last year and a half or so has made quite a splash, carving out a swath of territory, right, sweeping from Syria down through Iraq.
Well, and I think it's important to understand the role of European powers and the United States historically. In the Middle, in what's called the Middle East. The Middle East is itself a kind of weird term. It implies that there's a center and then an east and a west. Middle East on a globe, what? Anyway, the fact of the matter is that European meddling in creating colonies, empires, if you will, after the collapse of the last caliphate of the Ottoman Empire, mm-hmm. Has been horrendous. For example, the British during World War I promised Palestine both to the Zionist community and to the Arab communities. And that's why I often call England the perfidious Albion, because they, you know, sold it twice, essentially, and lied in both cases.
Yes.
So, you know, this is the kind of thing that we talk about. Now, that area of the world was divided between France and England, divvied up as the winners of World War I. And this is all part of what leads us into the modern age. The injustices that came out of World War I, the empires involved, and the onerous conditions that the Germans and their allies suffered after the war led directly to World War II. And the patterns of injustice continue and continue and continue.
And, of course, we can't ignore the fact that much of the Islamic world, that part that is concentrated in the Middle East, mm-hmm. Is also that land is also the greatest material prize in all of history.
You're
because that's
about
where the oil is at.
Oil.
Yes.
Oil.
Yes. Pardon my dangling preposition.
Well,
there.
And people do know, and this has been talked about on the show off and on for years, that we have come to the point beyond peak oil. That is to say, the actual amount of oil that we know about is decreasing. And we're going more and more into technological approaches to get oil that are very expensive and very destructive
very
of the environment.
Yes.
And that is what we're talking about when we talk about the tar sands or we talk about the Bakken oil in the Dakotas. In the case of the Bakken oil, the people, in order to get that oil out fast, are literally wasting 30% of the natural gas produced there by burning it and by letting methane out into the atmosphere.
Yes, and among those dangerous technological methods for securing the oil, one might include, war making.
War making is definitely a part of the scheme. When the idiot Bushes, thinking they could get the oil easily, destroyed the intolerably ugly but nevertheless stable government of Saddam Hussein, they unleashed forces about which, and this is why I emphasize the notion of jihad and the notion of the caliphate, they unleashed forces that had been pent up for years.
They did. And when I said earlier that ISIS owes its existence in large part to the United States intervention in Iraq, that's precisely what I'm talking about. It is highly unlikely, one might even venture to say impossible, that ISIS would have been able to carry out what it's done if Saddam Hussein were still in power and were still actively imposing his rule upon Iraq.
Yeah, ruthless though he was and horrible though he was.
Yes.
And the same is true true. I mean, if you look at Egypt, we all talk about the Arab Spring. We talk about the liberation of Egypt. That process was glorious and fun to watch, but it enfolded and became, first of all, the headquarters for the Muslim Brotherhood, which was then overthrown by the military, the same military that had dominated Egyptian politics for 20s, 30s, 30, 40 years. Hmm. And now we're back in that situation.
Indeed we are. So Barack Obama ended the war in Iraq, and I'm making air quotes now. He didn't really end the war in Iraq, but he did withdraw a large chunk of the American military forces that were stationed there. Mm-hmm. And in 2011, when that process had winded down, al-Qaeda in Iraq was being run by a guy named Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was the successor to Zarqawi. The al-Qaeda in Iraq changed its name, called itself the Islamic State of Iraq, or ISI, mm-hmm. Which eventually became the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. Mm-hmm. And that is where this group came from. Al-Baghdadi is still in charge and has adopted the title of caliph.
Right, an ambitious man.
An ambitious man.
Who many religiously motivated followers believe in. Let's go to the phones. 231-8187.
George, good morning.
What a wonderful topic, and you guys are really raising interesting issues. And I have several examples. In general, looking back, what little I know about the region, I have done a little bit of reading. In the 19th century, there was an Egyptian ruler, Muhammad Ali, who sought to modernize his country and set up studies of technology in many fields, and including, I believe, metallurgy and textiles and modern military order and in commerce, and he sought to educate his population. The British didn't like it, and they, after a few years, they blocked his efforts, strangled the effort, which was heading in a very liberal direction. The population was getting widely educated, and that destroyed that. Then, looking later on, during World War II, the U.S. was quite worried about the British in Saudi Arabia getting control of the oil, so the U.S. picked a right-wing fundamentalist sect, the Wahhabis, to put in power, and their leader, because by financing the king, the leader who became the king of Saudi Arabia, the U.S. could gain control over the oil of the area. And this was a sect that did not represent the majority of the region's population, nor, I might add, did it represent the, from what I've read, the more liberal views, if not, you know, non-Islamist, but the more liberal views of the population.
Well, in fact, the Saudi family, the ruling family right now, is endeavoring to modernize, but they're blocked entirely by, and very effectively, by the fundamentalism of the many religious scholars in that country.
That brings me to another point. In the era of Nasser in the 1950s, according to a book by an Islamic scholar who taught in the United States at one of the universities here, and I may mispronounce his name, but I read it as As'ad Abu Khalil, and his book is called Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New, quote, War on Terrorism, quote, and it was published by Seven Stories Press, which you probably are familiar with. Mm-hmm. And he says that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, during the Nasser period, set out to fight Nasser's attempt at a sort of feminist socialism by setting up fundamentalist colleges, which we now call madrasas, and were called madrasas then, to inculcate a very conservative, retrospective Islam, which the As'ad Abu Khalil refers to as Salafist, and I guess that's a sort of traditional fundamentalist. And so that's another example, and it apparently, with Saudi Arabia funding the foundation of these colleges and the U.S. helping them, they managed to create a large number of people throughout the region, and not only just in Egypt, but throughout the Levant, we could say, over the next 35-40 years. And so when we talk about fundamentalism as some kind of an inherent characteristic, we should be very careful. And then one last, I think this is the last example I have. The U.S. imposed the Shah of Iran on the unfortunate people who were trying and had been trying for 100 years to acquire basic Western liberalism.
Well, yeah, in fact, the CIA overthrew a legitimate elected government, a modern government in Iran.
Exactly, and they followed that with a reign of terror, murdering many of his followers. And then for the next 35 or so years, after until the Shah was overthrown, a cultural and economic strangulation and raping of Persia by the Shah and the CIA and the corporate regime in Iran occurred, with a crushing of writers, publishing, schools were fewer and far between. And so we point to the Middle East and we say these people are so fundamentalist and so poorly educated. We need to look at the effects of the U.S. and Britain and the very unrepresentative rulers whom the U.S. and Britain have put on the top in rule, you know, throughout the region, and whose populations regard these people with horror and loathing often, and yet there are these fundamentalist sects armed to the teeth, and this is partly, and I think largely, the doing of Saudi Arabia, U.S., and other allies.
Yeah, in fact, most of the weapons that the ISIS or ISIL have are actually weapons that were given to Iraq and to Syria and have been taken up. And they have very modern artillery and so on.
Mm-hmm. So I think that you were on this, you were sort of on the track of starting to talk about this, and I'd be very interested if you have more to add on this or someone else calls in, because this is one of the terrible things that the U.S. has done, and I might add it was done by Great Britain in India in a different way, but the idea is to appoint minority dictators, and we've seen this throughout Latin America, of course, who don't represent the people. And we then declare that we've established some kind of an acceptable semi-democratic regime, but it holds back in the Middle East. It's been particularly destructive to deeply committed forces for education in our terms of modern learning and science and literature and humanism for over 150 years.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments. I want to give some others an opportunity.
Hey,
we're running out of time.
Thanks so much, you guys, for this terrific program.
And I again want to emphasize to our audience, we are not experts on Islam or on the history of that region. I'm a generalist in world history. Abe is, what are you?
I'm just a generalist.
He's just a generalist. Yeah. And I think one thing I really want to emphasize in the case of Iran, that was a plot by the CIA and British intelligence and essentially by the oil industry to gain control of the oil in that region.
Yeah, biggest material prize in history.
And there's no question about any of that. So when we're talking about what has happened in the region, it is blowback coming out of imperialist oil interests involvement in the Middle East.
I'm really glad the caller brought those events up, because there's really no better rebuttal to the notion of American exceptionalism than the mess we're in because of our meddling in this part of the world.
Right. I absolutely agree. Even the existence of these nations and their borders were something set up by the Western powers.
Now, another unfortunate, I guess we'll have to get into this at another time, because we're out of time.
We're out of time?
We are. There's the music.
Oh,
and
yes.
The music means we're done.
I hope people found this useful. I readily acknowledge our lack of expertise. And I think the criticism a woman made earlier that it would be good if we could have Islamic scholars here is a good idea. This show doesn't do that. We're a talk show. But thank you very much for the calls.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. And we'll be back at you next week.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Do Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th to hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
Registration is now open for the Pacific Northwest Social Forum coming to Portland the weekend of September 26th through the 28th. The weekend will feature People's Movement assemblies on topics such as treaty rights, food sovereignty, housing justice, and more. The Social Forum will begin Friday, September 26th with the concert by KBOO Station co-manager Mike Crenshaw and friends. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this important and historic event where we, the people, will create the Pacific Northwest Plan of Action for social, economic, and climate justice. Information about registration, endorsement, childcare, or on the Pacific Northwest Social Forum in general can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon State Fair, Dia de la Familia, inviting you and your family to come out on Sunday, August 31st in Salem. A celebration of Latino culture, Dia de la Familia includes live Latin music, food, mariachi, ballet folklorico, face painting, and Chemeketa Community College women's soccer team at the Kids Kick Camp. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, journalist and author David K. Johnston speaks on the societal impact of inequality. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints presents special coverage of last Friday's march and rally for Alex Nieto, a young Latino man who was shot to death by San Francisco police. At 11, on stage and studio, host Dime Roberts speaks with Michelle Fuji, who was artistic director of Portland Tyco for 9 years, and her husband, Toru Watanabe. They just formed their own Tyco.